Rondo has the upper hand.
Mills!
Here he comes.
What?
I wish I could have lived like you did.
Shut up. What the fuck are you talking about?
Do you hear me, Detective? I'm trying to tell you how much I admire you. And your pretty wife.
What?
Tracy.
What'd you fucking say?
It's disturbing how easily a member of the press can purchase information from the men in your precinct.
I had just seen Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, and I walked out and I got in my dad's 65 Impala and I slid over these gigantic seats in front of this steel dashboard. And he said, "What did you think?" Because he loved the movie. And I said, "It was amazing." And he said, "So, what do you think about it? You know, what do you?" And I said, "I want to make movies." And he was like, "Great."
From London in England, my name's Simon Collum.
From Toronto, Canada, I'm the Mad Hatter.
And welcome this week to the Film Locker. Well, this week we are going to be looking at David Fincher.
We are indeed. This is episode number 7. Time flies, sir. We're into the back half already. Can you believe it?
I can't believe it. It's great to think that we've managed to see so many great filmmakers and talk about some really great, interesting stuff so far. I think now we're getting to a filmmaker who's so contemporary. He's always in the public eye. He's somebody who anybody who is in any way interested in filmmaking knows who David Fincher is, especially over the last year. So I think we're at a really great point now to celebrate somebody who I think everybody will be able to listen to this episode without any concerns.
He certainly is. He's a very good choice for these dog days of summer. Let's go to his bio.
David Fincher was born August 28, 1962 in Denver, Colorado. Though he was born in Denver, he grew up in Marin County, California, where his parents began to nurture his love for filmmaking at a young age, buying David his first Super 8 camera for his 8th birthday. As a teenager, Fincher was heavily inspired by George Lucas's 1973 film American Graffiti, and his excitement for the film grew exponentially with the fact that Lucas was actually his neighbor in Marin County. At the age of 18, Fincher decided against any sort of film school experience and instead went right at his goal. Before he was old enough to drink, he worked loading cameras and other such hands-on jobs for John Cordy's production company, Cordy Films. From there, he went to work for his idol, joining George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic, where he produced special effects for Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. After directing commercials for companies like Pepsi, Nike, and Sony, Fincher joined Propaganda Films, where he directed music videos like Jamie's Got a Gun for Aerosmith, Straight Up by Paula Abdul, and perhaps, most famously, Vogue and Express Yourself by Madonna. It was around then, in the early 90s, that Hollywood came calling. In 1993, he made his feature film debut with Alien 3, the handsome-looking but critically drubbed third part of the legendary sci-fi series. Fincher would notoriously spar with 20th Century Fox over the script and the edit, gaining a reputation for being a demanding director. Fincher continued making commercials and music videos while mulling over his next move, including winning a Grammy Award for his direction of the Rolling Stones video, Love is Strong. In completing his next feature film, Fincher would announce his presence with authority, unleashing 7 on audiences in 1995. Suffice it to say, the film was a cultural smash, marking the first of 3 times the director would team with actor Brad Pitt. Since 7, Fincher has received acclaim, including 2 Oscar nominations for Best Director. His films like Fight Club and Social Network have been hailed, while others like Panic Room and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button have been scorned. His movies are often dreary and violent, and thus far, he has found himself drawn to the story of society's misfits. By putting his own spin on influences like Coppola, Polanski, and Scorsese, David Fincher has made a name for himself as one of the rock star directors of the 20th century.
Okay, so that's going to give us a bit of background to David Fincher.
I think that we're both going to... This is going to be a director where we both have the same entry point, and that was 1995 with 7, a film that I saw in a theater and just really, really couldn't bend my brain around for the first little while. It was just so much different than the kind of films I was seeing. I think as far as everybody we've talked about so far, and even the ones that we're planning to talk about, not to give too much away, I think he's the director who I've been following since the start.
They're all filmed which you want to show people for whatever reason. You know, you want to show Guys Fight Club because it's so badass.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club.
You want to show, people who like their thriller 7 because the ending is so scary.
I tried to play husband. I tried to taste the life of a simple man.
Fly away!
You want to see show people about The Social Network because it shows such a great, interesting insight into Facebook and the politics.
You better lawyer up, asshole, because I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
I think he chooses projects which have got so much meat to them. It keeps him constantly relevant. And I think, that not all filmmakers do that. I think Fincher has a really good eye for projects which are really strong and from one line, you're interested in it. I mean, Panic Room, say, the idea of somebody in a panic room and it's trapped inside the building, and that's that. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it reminds me of Hitchcock's Rope and those films which are set within those small-scale environments. I love that.
You know what's funny, though, is that you mentioned the rewatchability of his films, and they are. Like, I've watched all of these films, even the most recent one, like the most recent two I've watched 2 or 3 times. Everything from Zodiac backwards I've watched multiple times. But they're really, really heavy, darker stories, you know? We're talking about murder several times over, we're talking about exploitation in the game, we're talking about home terrorism almost in Panic Room. They're not exactly what I'd call throw it on a day where you're homesick and just cozy up with the blanket. He really tackles some gritty subjects.
When we do talk about the likes of Panic Room, say, I mean, that was at a time when people were becoming a bit more fearful about their environment. I heard a speech only recently about how we were in this world whereby you can go anywhere in the world, at touch of a button and just getting on a plane and just flying anywhere. And yet the reality is that people don't even feel safe in their own home. And I think, that's very relevant at that time when Panic Room came about. And I think this is what makes the film so accessible.
Yeah, you know what the funny thing is about Fight Club, too, is that's actually a movie that has aged rather interestingly, because there's the iconic line of,
the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war. No great depression.
12 years later, and congratulations, we have both. Now, much like our last episode about Almodovar, David Fincher is a rather timely choice because he has a film coming out this year. Not to digress too much, but what do you think he might be able to bring to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Well, I remember they said that he hasn't watched the Swedish films.
Really?
But the trailer seems to indicate otherwise.
Yeah, I was going to say, seeing those clips, it almost looks like a direct pull.
Now, I think after Social Network, I think maybe he just wants to keep his name out there, and maybe he's a bit on autopilot. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Fincher is, Fincher on a normal day, is better than 90% of the directors on their best. But I think at the same time, it appears from the trailer that it seems to be it's a genre which he knows well, the thriller. It's something where he can go back to those roots, really exploit it, do very well at it, and then continue on with his filmmaking, maybe more personal films if he wanted to make in the future.
Yeah, what the funny thing is that when I watched the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo film, the Swedish film, it looked a lot to me like a David Fincher film anyway. Like, it looked like the director had seen Zodiac and Seven a few times and thought, well, I'm going to take this story and transpose it into that kind of style. So while I thought that was a good film, I'm really, really curious to see what Fincher will bring to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And, conversation as it may be about remakes and whether they are or are not a good idea, he's the sort of director who I'll always give him the benefit of the doubt and see what he can bring to a remake.
Yeah, I think he's definitely gained that credibility that his films must be watched to really have an opinion on. Okay, so one film which we reckon you should definitely watch, obviously, to understand Fincher in any respect, is Seven, which is our main film for our tour.
You know, this isn't going to have a happy ending. It's not possible.
Hey, man, we catch him, I'll be happy enough.
If we catch John Doe, and he turns out to be the devil, I mean, if he's Satan himself, that might live up to our expectations, but he's not the devil. He's just a man.
You know, see, you bitch and you complain and you tell me these things, and you mean, if you think you're preparing me for hard times, thank you, but...
But you gotta be a hero. You wanna be a champion. Well, let me tell you, people don't want a champion. They wanna eat cheeseburgers, play the lotto, and watch television.
Hey, how did you get like this? I wanna know.
There wasn't one thing, I can tell you that.
Okay, so Seven was released in 1995. It had a budget of only $30 million, so it's pretty cheap, really, in terms of the huge amount of money which it made, which was $327. It made absolutely loads. Based in a city which is just kind of nameless city, which is kind of destroying itself to some extent. And we have Morgan Freeman as Somerset, and we've got Mills, who's played by Brad Pitt, who are basically investigating a serial killer who is killing people according to the seven deadly sins.
I saw this one on a Saturday night, and it was the sort of film that I really, really wished I had caught at a matinee so that I could walk out into some sunshine, because this film is just so dreary and so gloomy. And we get to the fact that it's got the bummer of an ending. You know, we're not used to that. We're used to, if things not having a happy ending, at least things having a satisfying ending. Here we're left with just such a gut shot, which is kind of funny, because I quite often say about movies that I watch how much better they would be, or how much more truthful they would be if they had the down ending, if they had the dark ending. And, well, here we go. I get one, and it gives me this reaction of just absolute numbness and you know, wanting to huddle in a corner and cry. And I guess that's why filmmakers don't go to this kind of ending all that often.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I think part of this film, which is what attracts you to it, is the basic setup of these seven deadly sins. But what makes you come away from the film kind of horrified is that it takes this kind of something, with, you know, to some extent, the two cops, Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt, they're quite detached from the case. They're investigating it, obviously, as we see as the film goes on. But as the film progresses, they get more and more personally involved towards the end, where you have this thing where it's completely... their families are involved, you know what I mean? And therefore, when you come out of the film, you know, these horrific sides, you know, become so much more personally involving, even for yourself. And I think, again, that's a testament to an incredible script. And again, like you said, I mean, David Fincher, he's not a writer generally. I mean, you know, he's written his shorts. He's never written any of his feature films. So it's about him choosing these scripts and choosing these stories, which are so effective. Prior to this, the only film which he had directed was Alien 3. So to think that he came from the franchise of Alien 3 to 7, I mean, that's quite fascinating. I mean, you know, music videos was his thing, directing, amongst other things, Who Is It? The Michael Jackson show. So, I mean, it's incredible to see such a real place. I mean, we've got this city which is dirty, which is grimy, yet you can relate to, you know, the slums. I mean, living in London, you see the poverty in some cases. Living in any big city, you'll see the poverty. And he's created this world which you can relate to, but at the same time, he's put into it this story which is so sinister and shocking. It really makes you feel, you know, like you said, really dirty.
Yeah, now, the funny thing, actually, I want to back up to something you said where you were talking about how we have the two cops that are very, very detached. Because the thing that makes this story so interesting is we actually only have the one of the cops who's detached. Somerset is the one who says you have to close it off, you have to isolate yourself, you're never going to survive otherwise. Meanwhile, we have Mills, who, I don't know, I don't want to say he cares too much, but he cares quite a great deal, and that's the kind of thing that seems to come with him being new to the city and new to this police force. And it's, in a way, it parallels their reaction to the seven deadly sins, because the line goes that we see a deadly sin on every street corner of every day and we just don't do anything about it. So which of these two cops really has the right method? Is it, should we go down the road of self-preservation and steal ourselves off the way that Somerset does, or should we give ourselves over and carry all of it upon ourselves the way that Mills does?
Having said that, like you said, there's that very unique take on these two characters. It's also quite cliche in that you have this rookie, this new kind of hot-headed cop in Brad Pitt, but then you also have this veteran cop in Morgan Freeman.
You make it sound like a Lethal Weapon film.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, you know, you could say on the surface, you know, if you were like two cops, a new guy and an old guy, you know what I mean, you know, tackling the seven deadly sins, that could be very run of the mill. But the whole thing, this is why David Fincher is one of our choices, is that he changes something which could be very simple and he turns it into something which is absolutely engaging, personal and thought-provoking. And like you said, and even with the script itself obviously dictates how these, like you said, how it does reflect things in our society, which again makes it that much more personal.
I got a question for you, Simon. What do you think? You've mentioned it a few times. What do you think of the fact that the city is never named? The city is actually Los Angeles, as it turns out. Now, that's kind of funny because I was always under the presumption that the city was New York. But I've tended to start shying away from films that set themselves in major cities for no reason. It's almost as if every film either has to take place in Chicago, Los Angeles, or New York if they're North American films. But what do we think about just keeping the city nameless and calling it the city? And, you know, we have the Morgan line that this city changes people and this city has changed. How do you think that is as a decision for this film?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's genius. I don't think it's a problem at all. I think, if anything, it kind of highlights that kind of nameless nature of cities at the moment anyway. I mean, if you think about with The Wire, I mean, Baltimore is like the big focus point. I mean, it's all about Baltimore as an example. Now, Baltimore is just the one city they choose, representative of the countless other ones around. But the point is that it's clearly the focus point of the film. I think the point Seven is trying to make is that you still have these poverty-stricken areas. You still have these situations in any city. And I don't think it's fair to kind of suddenly name-check Los Angeles or anywhere else to say that that's the case, because it's not that's not the point. This is happening across the board.
Yeah, and I think the cool thing that does for Seven is, along with the fact that it makes it very, very easy to change its setting in terms of which city it is around the world, it's also really easy to change this film in terms of time, in terms of when it happens. Like, it looks, obviously, you know, there's a lack of computers and a lack of technology, so we know it's not from the new millennium, but this could be an 80s story, this could be a 70s story, this could be a 90s story. It's very, very timeless in that respect.
And you know that's a purposeful decision, because it completely focuses your attention on the here and now. It makes you have to consider whether these type of things are a feature of whatever decade, or whether they are relevant to today and because of the situation today. I mean, whatever the case may be, you know what I mean, that it's not something that has happened overnight. These cities whereby they've, you know, plunged into these problems, is something which has happened over time.
Yeah. The wild thing about this movie, the really, really crafted thing about this movie, is I think we can both agree that this is a rather dark and violent film. But of the six killings that John Doe commits, we don't see a single one of them.
That's very true.
You know, that's attention to craft right there, because if you handed this kind of property over to a schlock director, there would be the temptation to give us even just glimpses of what he's doing to the fat person in Gluttony. There would be glimpses of him, you know, getting the pride woman and you know, gluing the bottle and the phone to her hand. We don't see anything of it. We always see the aftermath, and our mind just fills in the rest. And I think that is pretty much a master stroke.
No, I think you're completely right. And I think it doesn't go so far to say, if you want your example of when they do show that, you move from Seven and you go to Saw.
Live or die. Make your choice.
Whereby, I remember the tagline for Saw was, if you like Seven, this takes it up to 8. And that doesn't really make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
But for some reason, the fact that it kind of nodded its acceptance of the influence of Seven on those films. I mean, Saw does show those things, but in the exact same way, Saw sets up this urban decay of this city, this nameless city, and these kind of old cops who are, in Danny Glover and Saw, it's very much the Morgan Freeman character. I think the influence this has had on cinema is, again, even more interesting, because it did completely set up the stage for those films in the future.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I think we'll wrap up our Seven discussion there, because I think one thing about Fincher is that we could discuss many of his other films in a lot more depth too. So we're going to have a quick break and come back to his back catalogue. Okay, so David Fincher has been, directing films, feature films since Alien 3. Prior to that, he was a music video director. Now, since then, obviously, we've got probably about 10 films, maybe thereabouts, that he's made. So we've got a few things to kind of discuss. If you were to mention a couple of films which maybe are not on a par with his best films, Hatto, which ones would they be?
Well, that's a kind of a tricky question, because I actually enjoy
I actually
enjoy them all to varying degrees. If I have to pick what I think is his weakest one, it is Panic Room, and it's hard for me to really zero in on why, because it's a great concept. Panic Room, it's stacked with the actors. It's got Forrest Whitaker and Dwight Yoakam as those really, really intimidating criminals. Jodie Foster doing her Jodie Foster thing, and it's probably Kristen Stewart's best bit of acting. I don't know why it feels a little bit slight. I think it's just because it's kind of his simplest concept. It's almost like it's pulp more than any of his other films. There's not really the greater story to latch on to the way there is with films like Zodiac or Seven or The Social Network.
It's so much more of a small scale. I mean, we're talking about a limited group of characters in one house, the vast majority of it in one room. That's something which is not really, you think about the expansive nature of Benjamin Button and even The Social Network, whereby, we talk, these people are setting up this worldwide, network. I think even Zodiac, when we move around San Francisco and all those different areas, I think that's the thing with Panic Room, it is that small scale. I don't think it's any worse. I mean, as I'm sure you're well aware, my concern is Benjamin Button. I think it's much weaker than any of his other films, which I'm sure we'll get to in a moment. But the point is that I'd say that's what makes Panic Room maybe different to the other ones. And people may argue weaker because of that. But I don't think that at all. I think there's some nice, subtle use of special effects as well in there, which makes it really good.
Yeah.
What about Fight Club? Fight Club, I think, is one of these films which, as a film blogger, comes up time and time again. The best film of the decade or whatnot. And people saying it's their favorite film ever. Would you agree with that?
Well, see, I'm a bit of a rigged deck, because Fight Club is based on one of my very, very favorite books, a book that I read before the film was coming out. I read the book a good solid year before the film, and it's a very, very wonderful adaptation of what I consider a great novel. Now, as far as what it does and its position and everything, I like it. I think it's a little bit overhyped at times. I think people don't always get some of what it's going for. I think they latch on a little bit too much to the anti-consumerist message or the, I think you need to be beaten up to really feel alive contradiction. But I really think that as far as a film that merges humor and counterculture. It's a really, really great example. It's actually one of my favorite movies ever.
No, I kind of agree. I mean, I think there's something about it. It has a real great pace to it. It has that really dirty side to it in the setting. Brad Pitt and Ed Norton, incredibly cast. It's got some really interesting issues, I think, as a guy to raise, but at the same time, kind of takes the piss out of it as well. You know, it doesn't really... I don't think it rams it home too much, and if anything, it kind of mocks the nature of of men who feel that they have to do certain things to kind of prove their masculinity and stuff. But I think, you know, I'm more interested in the commercialism side to it. I love that sequence when Ed Norton comes in and he sees visually all the items which he's purchased, catalog form, and the idea that people buy these things, and for what? I mean, what are we closer for them? Are we in any way more intelligent for them? Are we? No, I mean, they're just products. They mean nothing. We don't take them with us when we go, and I think that's a great sign to it.
Well, the one thing that I've been gravitating towards in his films is, and this is kind of a subtle art, is I'm really, really one for the editing. He's worked with his last two films, and going into The Dragon Tattoo, he's worked with Kurt Baxter. Prior to that, he worked with James Haygood. And his films always have such a distinctive pace to them. They've got, you can certainly see his roots as, and I do mean this in a very good way, you can see his roots as a music video director. You know, if you were to dig into his Wikipedia page, for instance, you can see some of the music videos he's directed, and they are landmark music videos. He directed Freedom by George Michael. He directed Janie's Got a Gun by Aerosmith, Vogue by Madonna. Like, what, talk about an iconic music video. And a lot of that comes down, obviously, because you're setting it to music, to the rhythm. And so that's the thing, is that when he gets his directors, guys like Haygood and Baxter, they really, really give his film. And Angus Wall, of course, has been his lead editor since Panic Room on every one of his projects, including The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And they really, really establish the pace and the rhythm of his films.
No, I think you're completely right. He definitely knows his music. I wrote a post a while ago, which I'm sure we'll link to on the blog, about his direction of the Who Is It music video, which is Michael Jackson. And it's, and you know, again, he does know how to use music effectively. And I mean, it's funny because when you think about the collaborations, like say when we talk about Howard Shore and David Cronenberg and Steven Spielberg and John Williams, I mean, these are filmmakers who work with composers time and time again. David Fincher chooses the relevant composer for the film in choosing Howard Shore for Seven and The Game and Panic Room. They are very moody films, and so he's relevant for it. Whereas Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross on The Social Network has that electronic feel which you want. So I think that's a great sign to it. Okay, let's go to the top shelf. Your top shelf choice.
Well, my top shelf choice I've been looking forward to since we decided to do Fincher in this series, because it's one of the very, very few films where you and I disagree. My top shelf choice is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and not because it's what I think is a shining example of David Fincher. Like, you know, if somebody tells me, I want to get into Fincher, what are the first three films I should look at? Well, Benjamin Button's not going to be in that choice. But what I think it is I think it's actually rather misunderstood, and I want to use this as a chance for people to possibly go back and revisit it. I'm not going to put a gun to anybody's head, including yours, Simon, because I know you've watched it twice.
Yes.
So I'm not going to go so far as to tell everybody, watch it again. But The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, what we have is a child who was raised as a senior citizen, as a child who was raised as an invalid in an old folks home, in a retirement home, in a nursing home almost. What does that do to his sensibility? What does that do to who he becomes and how he grows up and how he's able to relate to people? He meets this wonderful, just full of life dancer in Daisy, but he doesn't really know how to express his love the way that a 20-year-old would, because he's been raised as an old person. And that to me is a fascinating story.
Brad Pitt is also very slow at talking in the film.
I see. Well, there's also, you know, unfortunately the film has the stigma of it seems like it's Forrest Gump done again 14 years later or whatever it was. It seems like it was Forrest Gump for another generation. Forrest Gump, it is based on a novel. It's based on a 1986 novel by some pulp writer named Winston Groom. Curious Case of Benjamin Button. We're talking about a story that was written by F. Scott Fitzgerald. This is a tale that was written by one of the greatest authors in history. So you have a lot more to mine, first of all. So they were adapted by the same screenwriter, but I don't care. But what's the common link is that he happens to stumble through history. Well, no, not really. He goes off to war, but anybody who was around in that age would. And we have the backdrop of Katrina.
Why frame it with Katrina?
Okay.
Who cares? What's the relevance?
Okay. I will admit openly that Katrina is a bit of a misstep. It's very much unnecessary, but it's negligible.
Make the film like half an hour longer.
Nah, I don't know. That's the thing. I think that there is a lot to the story of Benjamin Button, especially when you think about it as somebody who's not only physically aging, but the way he's been raised is almost mentally aging in reverse. I think that there's a lot more to grab onto there than what we all first came into it and came away from it with lofty and dashed expectations.
Well, I know when I watched it, I could physically feel myself aging. But okay, enough said. I think I'm going to move on to my top shelf, and my choice is actually going to be equally, I think, as controversial, which is Alien 3.
Now, why was that your selection?
Now, Alien 3 is, I think, vastly underrated. I mean, I appreciate the flaws with it. I do think the special effects are dated. It's one of those films which they like with Star Wars. I think with Alien 3, they should update those special effects because they just don't even, it just looks completely wrong. But the point is that that's that. I think one thing about Alien 3, which is so important, is that it's iconic to some extent. I mean, I think we talk about the first two Alien films, and they've got this. They obviously got great pace. They've got great story. There's something new. They're completely polar opposites to each other in that one's a horror, one's an action film. But I think with Alien 3, it gets to this point where we've got this fantastic setup of this prison, and you've got this role whereby Ripley is literally turning into the masculine character. She shaves her head, and you have those, and she just looks iconic in just how she appears. I think Fincher's direction is incredible. I think how he directs this really, dark and dingy prison kind of predates all the dark and dingy worlds in Fight Club and Seven. And I think it's one of those films which I think I appreciate that he had a very tough time making. And it's fascinating to imagine if Danny Boyle directed Alien 3, because he was in the running earlier on. But I think David Fincher's direction of it is very telling of his style and his kind of his skill at that time. And I think, again, it's a film which I do enjoy when I watch it, more so than others at some points.
I have not watched this movie in a long, long time, so maybe I'll go back and revisit it. But it certainly is fascinating to see where a director like Fincher follows in the footsteps of legends like Ridley Scott and James Cameron.
But I think he completely holds his own.
Yeah, well, there we go. Some controversial choices on the top shelf this episode.
But I think let's go to some questions, which we'll come to after this.
Trivia, then. We have six questions, three from me, three from Hatter. Our email, obviously, you have to send the answers to the email, which is filmlocker@hotmail.com. First up, Hatter, your three questions.
Well, my three questions go like this. First of all, which David Fincher film received the most Oscar nominations? My next question is, which David Fincher movie got the highest box office upon release? I'm talking about its box office at the time. None of this adjusted for inflation mumbo jumbo. By the numbers, what got the most money? And last but not least, what is the last David Fincher film that was not based on a book? Fiction or nonfiction, what was the last screenplay that was an original property?
Nice, good questions. Okay, my three questions are, as we mentioned before, he's worked with a range of different composers. Which film did he work with Elliot Goldenthal on? My second question is, his budgets have generally fluctuated from about $48 million up to $150 million. Which film was his budget $150 million? And that can include The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And the last question is, his music videos, he's made music videos since the 1980s, but his latest one was in 2005, and he created a music video for one artist, and I need to know the artist and the track, and as a bit of a clue, it's not the first time he's worked with that. Okay, that's my three questions. As again, the email is filmlocker@hotmail.com, and any feedback obviously is greatly appreciated. We will get back in touch and email you back. If you want to hear more work from The Hatter, his blog is mcneilmatinee.blogspot.com.
And if you want to read more of the fine work of Simon Colum, his blog is screeninsight.blogspot.com.
And obviously the official blog for this podcast itself is filmlocker.blogspot.com. And we've got lots of different articles, all information on the directors we've discussed, reviews, analyses, all that kind of stuff will be on there. But I think we've kind of put David Fincher to bed. I think we're prepared now for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. How do you feel about that?
I'm ready. Bring it on.
Okay, we'll see you next week for another Film Locker episode.